Senator Bennett, Senator Eliason, Senator Ray, Senator John right here. Constitute a quorum. We have before us Senate Bill 443, sponsor Senator Halford. This measure extends the monthly reporting requirements imposed on surplus line brokers by requiring submission of loss data as well as the premium information currently required. I'd like to move along here. We have a sponsor of the bill, Senator Halford. Would you like to just go through this very quickly?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. A lot of the critical areas of insurance are insured through surplus lines, and the regulation that we have on surplus lines is nowhere near what it is on admitted carriers. Basically, we get the premium information, and that's all. Some of the carriers have offered loss and reserve information in the past, but it's a matter of whether they want to do it. This makes the broker responsible for providing that information, at least gets a better database in dealing with surplus lines carriers. There's one point I would like to make, and you can deal with it here, or I think we should deal with it in the Judiciary Committee, and that is in lines 18, 19, 20, and 21, it lists they're supposed to report the amount of losses experienced in the state categorized by the amount paid for settlement of claims and held for losses incurred in the state but not reported, i.e. not settled yet. I think that we may want to, after we research that in Judiciary, combine those categories, because I think if you have an insurance company listing a reserve for settlement, and if the company only has one major policy in one area, the plaintiff's attorney is going to go and see what the company held for reserve and is going to file for exactly the amount of that reserve. So the difference would be, instead of saying A and B, it would be take out the A and B, so it's the amount paid for settlement of claims and satisfaction of judgments and the amount held for losses incurred in the state but not reported. The Division of Insurance would be able to deal with that in a way that I think at least doesn't provide information to a plaintiff's attorney who is simply going to sue for whatever the reserve held is.
Okay, we have Mr. Polk here that we want
to go ahead.
Could you make yourself available for questions?
Yeah.
Are there any questions of the sponsor? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Don Koch with the Division of Insurance. Basically, we support this legislation. I would have to point out that I would not expect this kind of legislation to be real effective. However, it does send a pretty good message to that particular marketplace that we want more data than what we're getting. The reason why this will not be particularly effective is because this is an unregulated market. And when you're getting your information secondhand through a broker who, in effect, does not represent the insurer directly, the information he gets may be less than what you'd want. There is no way to directly reach the insurer, so this is not a bad step in between. It'll give us a little more leverage to get information. In some cases, it'll be effective. Other cases, it just won't be. But it does send a message. As to Senator Halford's concern with lines 17, 18, 19, I hadn't really considered that, but we could give you language, or the next committee, whatever you desire, that will meet his concern.
Okay, what? How about the suggestion of taking out sections A and B?
And just combining the information, I think that would work. I think that would work.
Yeah. Okay. Any questions there, Mr. Pope? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Is there anybody else here to testify on Senate Bill 443? The suggested amendment by the sponsor seems technical in nature. Go either with a committee substitute, or I understand that this bill is going to be requested by the Judiciary Committee. Currently, it's scheduled to go on to rules. What are the wishes of the committee? Would you like to see a committee substitute with that drawn in? Or would you wish to go ahead and pass the bill on?
Individual.
suggest to the Judiciary Committee your amendments on that, Senator Hopper. Okay, the Senate Bill 443 is then moved out of the Urban Commerce Committee. House Bill, our sponsor substitute for House Bill 20. Take that one up this time. It's an act relating to interest rates on deposits collected by public utilities. Sponsor of the bill is Mr. Gall. Is Mr. Gall here? Is any of the co-sponsors here to speak on behalf of the bill? We'll put the bill at the bottom of the calendar. Committee substitute for House Bill 217, Labor and Commerce. We have this bill before us. The Labor and Commerce, basically this bill amends the Small Loans Act and the Premium Finance Act, increases the interest rate and judgments and decrees from 10.5% to 14%, and increases service charge provisions of the Retail Installment Sales Act to 1.5% per month to or 18% per annum. And we've been working on a Senate committee substitute for House Bill 217, and possibly for the members and for the meeting, it might be better for us to adopt the Senate committee substitute for purposes of discussion at this time, or would you rather hear the arguments on both bills?
No, I'd like to point in information. When was this before the Labor Commerce Committee before? It's been before, please, ever?
This hasn't been before us.
But we have a committee substitute.
Well, it's a proposed Senate committee substitute. If you'd like, we can deal with the committee substitute for House Bill 217.
Move to adopt the committee substitute.
Senate committee. Objections? Okay, we have before us then Senate committee substitute, and then the testimony that we'll have then will be directed toward this bill, toward the Senate committee substitute. Do we have a sponsor or co-sponsor to the bill? Representative Ringstead?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Representative Ringstead, in District 20. As one of the co-sponsors on the bill, I appreciate you taking the bill up. I have looked at the proposed proposed committee substitute, and do support that. The area that I look at mostly in this, every time interest rates change, we think we have to establish interest rates to take care of people. In the credit card section of this thing, when interest rates were going up to 22, we thought we had to put a limit on there and say it had to be 18% or 1.5% a month. And rather than just let the markets take care of this the way markets do every place else, banks are no different. Now interest rates are down, and the people we were trying to protect a couple of years ago are getting the short end of the stick because we didn't allow the rates to float. And I think that's what we need to work with that and allow the banks the freedom to work just the way any other supply and demand thing does, and try and get it to where they can put the limits where they belong. If you get into it now where the people carrying large balances on their credit card are paying the 12% rate, the people with the small balances are paying the 18% rate, and so the people that can afford it pay the cheap one, and the people that can't afford it, we've got paying the high one, just because we keep trying to regulate it. So I would ask that you look favorably on this and try and get the bill moved along. I guess I can answer some questions in theory. I haven't done a lot of detailed work on the sponsors or the committee substitute of the bill, but answer questions if I could. I guess there's people that probably give you more technical answers on the industry end of it.
Okay, we did take out the most favored. No, we didn't. I'm sorry, we didn't take out that. We did change the bill substantially in dealing with the taken out the section that dealt with the credit unions.
Yeah, as I remember, which isn't a real problem, I don't think.
Okay, so basically the bill as it is right now simply relates to the interest rate on credit cards and interest on judgments.
Wasn't there one other section on the front of that? I don't remember. Those are the primary areas, yeah.
Are there any questions then of the sponsor? We have a number of people to testify on behalf of the bill.
I just have one basic question.
Senator Ray?
Well, the witness, the sponsor, is talking about what a good thing we're doing for all these people by raising the interest rate from 10.5 to 14, and I don't see where that's going.
Oh, well, on that one, what you're looking at is interest rates on judgments, and I guess directing my comments more to the credit card and the lending area. On the judgment area, where judgments are coming out against you paying the interest rate, that's fine. I can live with that section. I wasn't all that concerned with that section of the bill.
Yeah, well, if the interest rates are going down all over, and then we're going to raise interest rates on judgments.
Try not to get any judgments against you.
Doesn't click.
Well, I try and keep the judgments away from me.
And as far as the credit cards, I mean, what we're doing is we're allowing the local banks to charge the same things outside.
No sense in giving all the business to the outside guys.
Where's the break there? I mean, what
the outside
giving us a break.
The outside guys are charging lower rates than our folks are, and then they wind up with all the business, and our banks wind up without the business.
That's backwards. That's what we're trying to prevent
now. Right. That's what I mean.
That's what we're preventing.
We're trying to be competitive is what we're trying to do. And that, to me, in banking, the key is to be competitive. And we keep trying. We as government keep trying to regulate the rates.
We like you were a banker. Are you a banker?
Used to be. I guess if you want a conflict interest, I now own stock in a bank too.
So
or proposed conflict
I'll
interest.
I'll tell you mine.
Okay, any further
what
questions?
Kind of interest rate are you going to charge me?
Any further questions?
Oh.
Sponsor? Right. Thank you, Representative Insel. We do have a number of people here to testify on House Bill 217. Let me ask this first. Is there anybody from out of town or that needs to catch an afternoon flight that's here to testify? From the audience. Okay, then going on down the list then, Mr. Jenkins?
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gary Jenkins. I represent the National Federation of Independent Business, a organization whose membership primarily are small businesses throughout the state of Alaska. And I might mention for the record that one of the requirements that NFIB has for me to take a position on an issue is I can only do so if the membership has voted on that specific issue. So. With that in mind, there are only two sections of the proposed CS that I will be speaking to, and they are the Section 4 and Section 5. The other sections, 1, 2, and 3, we do not have a position on at all. Section 4, as the sponsor has indicated, would set the maximum limit that could be charged on a credit card or other retail charge agreement at 1.5% a month. As was explained, the current limit is on the first $1,000 is presently 1.5%, and then on anything over that, it floats at 5 points over the federal discount rate, which presently makes the rate 12%. Might note, as kind of in response to some of the questions that were brought up with the first speaker, and that is the fact that this is only setting an upper limit. Obviously, a bank, a business, anybody with retail credit can charge less than the limit, but it is only setting a maximum limit. This issue has been in the legislature for many years. Our membership has voted on it actually two, if not three, different times in various configurations. The response of the membership has always been very consistent. And I also would like to make sure it's clearly understood is that this would permit businesses to increase their rates also. And when I posed the question to our membership, I separated out, you know, retail charge accounts, credit cards, and so forth. And the scope of the bill has narrowed dramatically. I did have at one time a whole litany because the original bill had a whole litany of different types of interest rate limits. Dealing specifically with what's now left in the bill, namely business retail charge accounts and credit card accounts, our membership has voted very consistently, basically 80% opposed to any change and 15 to 20% in favor. I recently met with representatives of the banking community, and they suggested to me something that intrigued me to a certain degree, and that is that if this proposed CS were adopted, that perhaps two things would transpire. One, that in fact, with a higher maximum rate overall, that perhaps the composite rate, i.e. the rate charged to the people under $1,000 might actually go down. And secondly, and I'm sure you're going to hear this in testimony, and secondly, that the rate charged to merchants for handling the transactions potentially would go down. I requested that be given in writing so I had some assurance that perhaps that maybe would be in fact, and unfortunately was not able to obtain that. So I must assume that that may be there, but I think I had better stick with what the strong position of our membership is and say that we still, based on, you know, the specific vote of our membership, again, representing in excess of 4,000 small businesses across Alaska, feel that the legislature should just leave the rates limits where they are and not tamper with them. With regard to Section 5, Section 5 is basically an amendment or change to what was Section 5 in the House, or Section 7 in the House bill, correction. Section 7 was put in the House bill, 217, I believe in an attempt to basically put all banks in the state of Alaska on even footing. Current practice is that a national bank in the state of Alaska, or several national banks, I should say, in the state of Alaska, are opting for using a most favored lender doctrine on loans under $25,000 and are charging basically any rates that they want to under that concept. This provision, what was Section 7 in the House bill, was an attempt to put everybody on equal footing and basically override that most favored lender doctrine and say that basically the states had to abide by state law, or the banks had to abide by state law. The revision in the committee substitute would basically delete that and just says that the state's electing not to override, which basically means nothing. And so we would suggest, because we supported that concept of putting all banks on even footing, or all financial institutions on even footing, we would support the concept of putting the original Section 7 back in this bill if in fact it is your desire to move the bill on. I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions there?
Okay, thank you.
Dick Hall?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Richard Hall, and I'm Senior Vice President of the National Bank of Alaska. Mr. Chairman, if I may just take a minute here to respond to a couple of comments made by the previous witness. I'm kind of always confused a little bit when the independent businessman in Alaska wants to give an out-of-state business a better position than one in Alaska takes. And I've talked to Mr. Jenkins about this, and I'm sorry we did not get our story completely through. Just trying to read my testimony today, if I could, please. It's not very lengthy, and I think you'll follow a little bit what we're thinking about on this particular piece of legislation. My remarks are pertaining to the committee substitute for Senate Bill, for House Bill, rather, 217. There are three banks offering credit card services in Alaska. The First National Bank, Reach National Bank of Alaska, and Alaska National Bank of the North. And while I can speak for only our own bank, we have discussed this legislation over the years and find we have similar views and support passage of the bill in its current form, but may approach any rate changes from a different philosophy. There's obviously a competitive position that each bank has here, and we're already competing under different rate structures at the present time. Approximately 150,000 Alaskans who have Visa and MasterCharge cards issued by Alaska banks are not getting the full benefit of falling interest rates. a result of the way Alaska's laws on credit card interest rates are structured. What's more, current state laws are placing Alaskan banks who offer card services at a competitive disadvantage with new competition from out of state. Banks who have recently captured about half of the Alaska credit card market and who ironically charge substantially higher rates than the local banks. This results in Alaska banks being disadvantaged, local jobs jeopardized, and in consumers paying higher rates and getting less services than they would be if we adopt HB 217. Passage of this bill will allow the open market to establish rates. Current law leads to the opposite of state policy that should promote consumer protection, local employment, and business development in Alaska. Alaska's law is the problem. Alaska is one of the five states with laws restricting interest rates on charge cards that are, on the average, less than they would be in the open market. But the real problem is not so much the limit, but the way the limit is structured. Alaska has a two-tiered limit, a top rate of 18% on the first 1,000, and a lower rate on balances over 1,000 that floats at 5 points over the Federal Reserve discount rate. Because the discount rate has been falling, this lower rate is now 12%. Like any other price control, these limits create distortions and shortages in the marketplace. The shortage is in the ability of Alaska banks to offer lower-cost credit card services to local consumers, many of whom must turn to out-of-state cards which charge higher interest rates. Alaska law, therefore, results in services being denied to people the law is intended to protect. State laws do not apply to out-of-state banks who issued cards under more liberal laws of their home states. Those cards you're carrying from Citicorp, Manufacturers Hanover's, are not regulated by Alaska statute. Some of these rates approach 20%. For example, Sears will be charging 19.8 with its new Discover card and plans to aggressively promote the card nationwide in 1986. Bank of America charges 19.8, and even Citibank, the largest bank in the nation, 19.8. But an almost bizarre distortion is this. The two-tiered structure of the Alaska law creates a situation where a majority of card owners who carry relatively low balances on their cards pay the maximum 18% rate, while a minority of more affluent card owners can carry larger balances at the lower 12% rate. In effect, they use the card as a source of cheap credit. In other words, the less affluent majority are subsidizing the low credit card rates to a more affluent minority. The solution, HB 217 now before you, would partially deregulate Alaska's limit on credit cards rates by removing the limit on balances over $1,000. The 18% maximum would remain. That would be the legal rate in the state. Actual rates on this portion today would fall in the current interest rate environment. This has happened in other states where one uniform interest rate limit has applied. It is also demonstrated in Alaska, where due to a technicality in the Federal Credit Union statute, a credit union in Alaska is able to charge up to a legal maximum of 21%. But in actuality, they are only charging 16.5%. This is one reason why, if current laws were changed, the majority of Alaskans with locally issued bank cards would see a reduction, possibly to 16.5 or less. And Mr. Chairman, I can quote to you that that is our position. We intend to do that if the law passes. But just as important, sufficient earnings would enable local banks to extend services to far more people. These are the people who would enjoy the greatest benefit under the change, since they would not have to buy or look for services to the more expensive or higher rate out-of-state cards. With earnings now restricted, local banks are themselves restricted as to how widely they can offer card services. Credit card operations are much more complex and expensive to operate than conventional bank lending activity. Because of this, Alaska banks must be restrictive in the issuing of cards. The system results in people being turned away. Out-of-state banks, because they charge higher rates and have huge volumes, can afford to be less restrictive and therefore more competitive in Alaska. Who wins and who loses with passage of HB 217? The winner would include most Alaska consumers and, yes, local banks who offer card services. The majority of those now holding Alaska-issued bank cards would see a rate reduction. But the real winners are those now unable to get local cards, who must buy cards from out-of-state banks. They would enjoy the most substantial gain. Other winners would include those employees who work in the credit card and accounting departments of banks offering card services, whose jobs would be more secure because the banks can be more competitive against out-of-state competition. The losers, to some extent, a small number of those relatively more affluent Alaskans who can take advantage of the current system by using their credit cards as a source of inexpensive credit. For these people, rates would increase. Other losers would include out-of-state banks for certain. Alaska bank card services with lower rates would be able to serve far more people and capture back that portion of the market lost to the competition. Mr. Chairman, 17 years ago, we brought the Visa card to Alaska. We brought it because the consumer demanded it for the use and convenience of the card, for the convenience use of the card. It was a service to the smaller merchant who could be relieved of the burden of carrying expensive credit services or accounts receivable and enable them to compete with a larger retail such as a Sears, Penny's, and etc. And providing the service, the local banks had hoped to make a profit. Unfortunately, times have changed. The program no longer benefits the consumer, many of whom are driven to buy out-of-state cards at higher interest rates. Alaska banks have not attained their profit objectives and further have been put into a disadvantaged position against out-of-state card issuers. While merchants have benefited, they could benefit even more through this legislation. Mr. Chairman, if there ever was a state policy contrary to the spirit of Alaska Hire, benefits to the consumer, and local preferences, we are now in that position. We urge you to pass this committee substitute.
Any questions?
You mentioned Sears and Roebuck is coming out with a national plan charging, what, 21% or 19.5%? And I'm not quite sure why, if they're charging those rates, Alaska people would be going towards those cards when, in fact, they get a card in Alaska cheaper.
Mr. Chairman, it's a, Secretary Eliason, let me explain this a little bit so you understand. A credit card issued by an out-of-state bank, and that Sears has a bank issuing their credit card, is not regulated by any local state. It'll be a nationwide card called the Discover card, which will come out. That card, conceivably, could only be offered in states with restrictive usury. They could withdraw their Sears charge card. It's designed to eventually replace that. Looking down the line, you're probably going to find JCPenney's and other large retailers doing the same thing, going to the credit card in order to have a uniform program nationwide.
Mr. Hall, you made two or three remarks and allusions to a certain group of affluent Alaskans are the only ones going to take advantage of the ones that have the advantage now. And they use the credit card as a means of cheap credit. I don't quite understand what you're saying.
Well, Senator Ray,
why are you saying that?
As you know, with a credit card, there is a limit established, which is different than a consumer loan that is taken across the counter. A customer of a credit card service will come in and say, I would like to have a limit on my card. And he may say, I want a $3,000 or a $5,000 limit. The more affluent you are, the higher limit you can attain on that card. You have a better net worth. So when he needs some money, it's one of the cheapest sources of credit. He can just access the credit card. In other words, he will take charges at different trips, clothing, and use it as a borrowing source.
Well, can't somebody that's got a $1,000 limit, don't they have the same way as long as they pay their bills on time?
You're talking two different concepts here, Senator. Number one, you're talking about the person who qualifies for a $1,000 card. They could only run up a total bill to $1,000. If they elected to carry it through the period, they would be paying the full 18%. If they elected, the other portion is if they elect to pay in full, they pay no interest. That would be the 30 days of gathering and the 25 days to pay period. Everybody has that option. But if a person has a limit of $1,000, because that's all that the bank feels that they should have under their credit capacity, then charges stop at that point, and they're the ones that pay the 18%.
They pay 18% of it, which is the same as those people in the manufacturers, Hanover, or one of the others, don't they? Aren't they
no,
Senator
Ray.
The same there?
Senator Ray, you're missing the point here that I said a minute ago. Our out-of-state competition is charging 9.8 or 18.8, and some even lower. What I'm saying is if this law passes and allows us to have one ceiling in the state, I will commit that our bank is going to go to a 16.5 rate or better in today's interest rate environment. The legal maximum of 18 will be there during a higher interest rate environment. Let me also point out the cost of funds is only one portion of what makes a credit card operation expensive. We have employees that we have to pay. Those wages don't come down because the interest rate economy comes down. Our telecommunication costs do not come down, nor do our losses on loans. So interest rates are only one factor that makes up the credit card complex.
Well, that's the only thing that the people, the consumers, interested in is the rates.
Senator Ray, the people will enjoy a 16.5 rate better than an 18%
well,
rate.
That's what you're saying. I mean, that you're selling a commodity.
Mm-hmm.
And you insisted that your bank is one that I've dealt with for many years, and I've always been really satisfied with it. I've never seen you as a leader in raising interest rates. I've never seen you giving anything free to the customer other than good advice, like don't borrow money. Your bankers are very good at that. But what I'm getting at is how you can sit there and say, if you got such a good deal, and if it's such a good deal now, it would seem to me that people would want your card more than they would Hanover's or some outside bank. And yet you say that the outside banks are charging more interest than you're charging. So why wouldn't they just automatically go to you now instead of waiting until they made a change and with the promise, an illusionary promise, mm-hmm. that somewhere down the line you're going to go to 16.5?
Senator Ray, we're seeing those applications today, and we are disapproving people who have an opportunity to get an Alaska credit card. We have certain criteria. Different banks have different criteria.
Well, then you are marketing.
Like maybe 6 points, 6 months on the job. Those people are being denied because we have no room to take a risk factor.
But somebody else is using the risk factor, so mm-hmm. then you are competitive, right?
They're taking the risk factor, but they're also taking the employees out of state.
But how does it make them competitive by raising the rates?
We're not raising the rates. We're lowering the rate for 2/3 of the people, Senator.
That's your way of looking at it. The other people looks like you're mm-hmm. 1/3 full and 1/3 empty.
Mm-hmm.
Or 2/3 empty.
Senator Lashley.
I guess what you're saying then, by passing this bill, you're passing the risk on, you're taking the risk from your bank to expand the business into the people who are doing business with your bank. Is that what you're doing?
If we can have enough margin of profit to take on additional risk, we will. Now, let me point the
difference. Well, you say right here that you're restricted to how widely you can offer your card services,
mm-hmm.
but we can expand our business if you take the risk. We won't. That's how I read this.
I don't follow your question exactly, Senator, because we're saying that we are restricting our card issuance now because we do not have enough return to do extensive verification and checking. And if this law passes, we will have an opportunity because we will be increasing that 12% rate, remember. That's what's going to pay for the
program. You won't do it now because of the risk involved. You can go as far.
Now, we will not do it now because we have to have the 18% on the first, because the 12 is legal maximum. We cannot increase the 12% rate on the current law. That's the problem. It's the 12% portion that's the problem. If Federal Reserve discount rate drops, and it should within the next few weeks, we'll be at 11.5% on that. One reason that we keep the program, instead of relocating or making other business decisions, it's only 5% of our total portfolio. It's important to us, but doesn't drive the horse.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator,
when this bill was introduced about 4 or 5 years ago, the prime rate was at where? 15%?
What date do you want?
Well,
this bill's been introduced for several years, but the peak of the prime rate, or the Fed discount rate, which is more appropriate for our discussion, was 14% in November of 81.
14%?
That's right.
And then,
that's the highest prime rate we've seen in the past.
It's down to what? Now, is this where you get your funds to?
No.
Don't use that source for funding?
No. Our funds for paying for the credit for lending come from our depositors, And through deregulation, more of our deposits are costing us more money. As an example, the money market account has come online. The interest on savings was deregulated the first of the month. We've increased
well,
those rates.
Well, they're paying the money market, which was up around 16 or 18% just a couple of years ago. Then I can understand you'd have a squeeze, but it seems to me at that particular time, and this particular time, you know, there's a big difference. You're paying maybe, what, 6.5%, 7% now on money rates? Maybe 8%, I guess. So it's came down 6% since this bill's introduced. How does that affect your attitude towards the passage of this bill when you've had that much reduction in what you're paying your own depositors?
Probably a couple of years ago, we would have said we needed a full 18% across the board, and today we do not need that much.
How many cardholders are there now, approximately?
There's approximately 150,000 in the three Alaska banks. And most families carry two credit cards, so it's a little hard to say what the true break is. 1.9 is kind of the average.
And then you've pretty much gone on hold then on the issuance of new cards?
Yes, all the banks have. We've been about this same level for several years.
With the passage of this, how many would you anticipate going out?
Each bank will have to look at their own criteria and determine what their game plan will be, but I think you'll find a larger percentage of Alaskans getting credit cards, because a couple areas we will be able to do is hire more people to review the applications. As an example, a college graduate out of school is an automatic disapproval today. Those people would probably qualify for a card. And other state employees, another area that we'd probably pick up quicker if they're employed, where today we have a 6-month employment criteria.
Okay. Mr. Jenkins made a comment there that something effect there that if this were to pass, then we could see, as far as the businesses were concerned, a decrease there in the
merchant discount.
What
we're talking about there is merchant discount now is used to make up part of our revenue stream to keep the credit card operation healthy. The annual fee, the merchant discount, and the interest all go into the pot, so to speak. But we're saying if you could put the proper weight where it should be into the proper category, like the borrower in this case, there's room for each merchant to renegotiate his contract out. We're receiving quite a bit of competition now from First Interstate of Washington, as an example, and Seattle First National on that merchant discount.
I guess maybe I don't understand the banking business, but it seems to me that you have the differential interest rate that you have now, if you're going to have people paying the 18% on $1,000, and then everything over that 18% would be 12%, and people would be more inclined to pay that 12% off or something. And
it's not how it works. Everybody pays 18 on the first 1,000,
right.
And it's only above the 1,000 that you get the break. You see, it doesn't. You can't avoid the 18. In effect, if you're into the borrowing pattern.
Senator Ray,
what's your risk factor on your cards? What's the bank's risk factor?
Senator Ray, I thought you might ask me that question because I just happened to bring here what the risk factor is. This is kind of the charge-offs for this particular month. You lose because of a bankruptcy. This customer was a customer of ours since 1977. There's another customer, $6,500, a customer since 1974, filed Chapter 7 bankruptcy. These are things that you have in the credit card.
On a credit card.
This is the credit card loss.
Okay, but how do you lose? How do you lose when a guy, how do they lose?
You also lose on fraud losses. Fraud losses, here's some here.
You charge back the guy that sent it to you.
No, you don't send
it. You always did with me.
We end up with...
For 20 years, it's 6 years or 10 years, how long you had it, I never... Anytime I sent you one, you always sent it back, and I had to pay.
I would say this, Senator, that when you were in business, if you had a credit card charged back, you did not properly fulfill your share of the requirement on the verification of the card.
You're out of my world.
Our fraud losses come because of, here's one in Hong Kong, somebody lost a card. This one was lost in racquetball court someplace, or customer lost his wallet in the house, these kind of things. These are the losses that are different than a regular consumer loan loss.
Same way with your checks. When you're in business, you charge back your NSF checks back to the guy that gave them to you.
Senator Ray, let me answer this way. If you're opposed to the Alaskans getting a benefit from a better credit card rate, then I would tend to agree with you. But holding this bill is going to limit our ability to serve our constituencies, which are also yours.
4,000 people here in business are not supporting it.
I don't really agree in that, and I think that the question we're asking again.
Mr. Jenkins has said 4,000. Yeah. I heard what he said.
We have 150,000 people in the
country. 80% of those.
Yeah.
Oh, 80% of those 4,000.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Senator.
Senator Leisenfeld, Mr. Chairman, if we're getting down to gut feelings, if there were a lot of support out there for this particular bill, the consumers, you know, I'm sure that I would have received some letters saying, it's a great idea, raise the interest rate, I'm not paying enough. But the people who have taken the time to study it, like the small business people, say, hey, then they've been polled a number of times on this particular issue, and I would suspect they wouldn't have taken the opportunity to look into it a little more closely if they're business people and they want to know how it's going to affect their business. And 80% of them say no.
Sir, let me ask you a question.
Isn't there an ingredient missing?
Who knows more about fishing, you as a fisherman or me as a buyer of the product? I think we know more about the credit card the same way you do about fishing. We think that this bill is in the best interest, and I said for the various three reasons. Primarily, there will be a rate reduction to 2/3 of the consumers, roughly, that have our cards. Number two, it will allow us to compete with out-of-state cards, which we are not now able to do, which is certainly not a public policy of the state. Number three, we'll continue to hire new people to work in our credit card departments that are primarily the people such as our clerical staffs. Now, passage of this bill, or no passage, gives us an option. We then can say, why don't we relocate our credit card out of state and do like the city corps do? Just come in here and mail things around, tell people to use a phone-up service. We're an Alaska business. We're trying to provide a service in the state. And our current policy is not conducive to that. Therefore, we urge that you pass this law to make us more competitive. We're not asking for more than the stateside banks. We're not asking even for as much as they have. We're asking for a chance to set a limit at 18 and set our own rates in a competitive environment. That's all we're asking.
One more comment there, and I guess we do have a couple other people to testify. When we came down here in January, there was a nationwide effort or concern expressed in Congress at the national level to look at the skyrocketing interest rates on credit cards and to begin to look at lowering those or
right.
steps in that direction.
Those actions are still in the rhetoric stage, Senator. I think that primarily a reduction in national credit card rates by the federal government would apply to us, unless I'm mistaken. And all we're asking for is equality. We're not asking for more than anybody else. Apply to us. And this is like it would in California or any place else. There are 19 states that have no limit on credit cards and many more that have a higher rate than 18.
Would that apply to Sears and Penny's and everybody else?
Yes.
What's the annual interest paid?
Manufacturers is 18.8.
18? No. I mean, what you showed me the other day.
Yeah.
There was 16 the other day.
I don't think so, Senator. Yeah. The Alaska Federal Credit Union anchored to 16.5.
I've received bill on this. One letter.
It's a banker.
No, banker's way.
Senator Ray said he had received no constituent mail, so.
Well, he was accommodated.
Yeah.
Okay, are there any further questions from the bankers?
Lobbyists.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Mr. Magnuson?
It's a good idea of kindness and advice.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Don Magnuson. I represent the Alaska Retail Association, which includes in its membership, I think probably all, or at least most, of the retail credit grantors in Alaska. I'm here today to offer just a brief statement in support of proposed committee substitute for House Bill 217, specifically Section 4 of the bill. Retail credit grantors of Alaska are in need of relief from the existing statute. As presently written, the service charge rates on balances in excess of $1,000 are limited to 5 percentage points above the Federal Reserve discount rate. That rate was recently dropped to 7% by a 4-3 vote of the Federal Reserve Board, which places the limit at 12%. That in itself is no great problem, since no retailer had been charging more than that on balances in excess of $1,000. The potential problem lies with the Federal Reserve Board, which can change the discount rate without notice and is likely to do so fairly soon. This would cause serious problems with retail credit grantors to meet federally mandated notification requirements and would, in the event of further reduction in allowable rate, cause additional financial loss in the extension of consumer credit. No retailer makes money on the extension of credit at a rate of 1.5% per month or 18% annual. At a rate of 12% annual, it goes without saying that losses are suffered. The Alaska Retail Installment Act was enacted in 1962 when the average prime rate was 4.5%, or one half of today's rate. The CPI is over three times what it was in 1962, so in 1986 we have prime interest rates of twice what they were in 1962 and CPI over three times what they were then. The cost of retail credit to Alaskans since then has increased not 1% in that 34 years. How many other products and services can you say that about? Shouldn't retailers get a small break? Proposed committee substitute for House Bill 217 brings some much needed relief, and I urge the committee to move this bill on to the Finance Committee. Mr. Chairman, I have also just looked up a very rough scale on what actually is involved in a purchase of $100 on an open account, assuming that it is paid off over a 12-month period. The average balance is $50. Revenue generated from that account would be $8.50. The cost of borrowing funds at 10%, which is in truth lower than what most accounts receivable can be financed, would be $5. Postage on that account would be $2.64, assuming that just a single statement per month was mailed to the customer. Bad debt cost of a dollar, personnel costs, rent are all something that vary tremendously from one operation to another. The net result is that total costs far exceed the revenue generated by that account.
Well, then how do you make money?
Obviously, the losses have to be made up in the cash price of merchandise. So, in order to finance the credit operation, cash prices have to be increased.
Do you have the same membership, or any of your membership, prior to Mr. Jenkins?
Some are, yes.
You're the 20% of them?
Probably, yeah.
Hi. That's fair. Well, there's some independent side, 15%.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Willis Kirkpatrick. I'm Director of Division of Banking, Securities, and Corporations. I'd like to just briefly make a statement on the first couple sections of the bill. They relate to more or less housekeeping, the 10.5 that's pointed out in Section 1 and 2. relates to the rate that is quoted in AS 4545-10A as 10.5. So that's just basically housekeeping, making it clear. On Section 3, interest on judgments, I don't have any comment on that. On Section 4, as testified earlier, I don't have any state-chartered financial institutions that are issuing credit cards on their own behalf. However, I have testified in prior years that I'm generally opposed to usury rates in the state of Alaska, and that's primarily due to the fact that the asset side of the balance sheet has been deregulated nationally, and Alaska has just recently been quoted in the American Banker as having the highest rates being paid on passbook accounts. There is somewhat of a war going on in Anchorage on the amount of rates that can be paid on passbook accounts, primarily because the state of Alaska is becoming short on core deposits in relationship to the number of financial institutions in competition. But that doesn't really relate to Section 4 because I don't have any financial institutions who are issuing credit cards. I'm vitally concerned about Section 5. Somebody testified earlier that the prior bill was asking for a level playing field by expressly overriding federal preemption, and that's backwards. If the original committee substitute was adopted, the state-chartered financial institutions, that would be state-chartered banks, mutual savings banks, savings and loans, and credit unions that have state charters, would have one rate and fall under state statute as far as that rate, and nationally chartered financial institutions would have another rate. By using Section 5, electing not to override the federal preemption, then there will be a level playing field. There is a doctrine that has come out of the Comptroller of Currency's office which states that the national banks can charge the highest rate that the state has. In the case of Alaska, the highest rate that we have is located in the Small Loan Act. So the national chartered financial institutions, through the most favored doctrine, can charge for like loans those rates that are charged or allowed under the Small Loan Act. Because of the provisions of the Depository Institution Deregulation and Monetary Control Act of 1980, Congress provided that state chartered federally insured depository institutions could also fall under the most favored lender doctrine. And because of that ruling under that particular act, then we have a level playing field. And as far as interest rates are concerned today, it is a level playing field.
What does that mean? Where are the interest rates? Can we put it in terms of numbers?
Okay. Under the Small Loan Act, it's a sliding tier, but under the Small Loan Act, they can charge under certain levels of loans, they can charge up to 32%, and that would be for loans that would be subject under the Small Loan Act. If without the Section 5 that we have, without the new committee substitute, the national chartered financial institutions would be able to charge a maximum of 32%, say for a $500 loan over a short period of time, where the state chartered financial institutions, it would be at 12% or under the usury provisions of Alaska law. So I urge you to pass in the committee substitute, for the committee substitute, the present Section 5 that you have before you.
Okay.
What could they do anything?
They're operating presently under the Most Favored Lender Act, so there wouldn't be any particular problem as far as a level playing field is concerned on interest rates. In the credit cards, I really don't have a resource, Senator, to answer that particular question because I'm basically out of the credit card regulation, not having any. I'm not really aware as to what the other states are doing. Mr. Chairman says he has that information.
Any further comments, sir?
I have no further comment.
Just one. Sir Elijah.
I'd like to Section 5. You say that should be a part of this bill if we pass this bill. Or do you want the old?
No, I do not want the old one. I want what is on the committee substitute before you.
Did you testify against the old one?
Yes, sir, I did. I'm trying to remember. I don't think I had an opportunity to. Yeah. But prior to those amendments, they did have an amendment that seemed to pick on the credit unions. They wanted the credit unions in the state to be at 15%. Well, we only have two state chartered credit unions, and there's 27 federally, so the two states would be charging 15%, and the 27 federally chartered credit unions would be charging up to 21%. And that was the part that I really vehemently opposed. And then the next thing I knew, there was an amendment.
When you decline to override something,
it's a little confusing. It's kind of like writing something in the negative twice.
I'm trying to figure it out.
Okay, the provisions that Congress put in that said that if the rate of the state is below 1% below the discount rate of the commercial paper offered in the district that the bank is located in, then it is preempted. And so what we're saying is that we don't want to overcome that preemption. We elect not to preempt. I have an explanation written by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation that I'll make available. I noticed that your aide has it.
Okay. Do we have copies?
Just
any further questions? Thank you very much.
Senator, I can answer Senator Elias' question.
Yes, all right.
If I may, please. Let me just go through state by state the legal rate on credit cards. I must point out the legal rate is not the legal rate that's always charged. Alabama, 21%. Alaska, 18% the first 1,000, 12 above. Arizona, no lift. Arkansas, which is a bad state, it's one of the five. 5% over the Federal Reserve discount rate, or 17%, so that's not as great as it sounds. California, no limit. Colorado, 21. Connecticut, 18. Delaware, no limit. District of Columbia, 24. Florida, 18. Georgia, 18. Hawaii, 18. Idaho, no limit. It's a West Coast state. Illinois, no limit. Indiana, 21%. Iowa, no limit. Kansas, 21%. Kentucky, 21. Louisiana, 18. Maine, 18. Maryland, 18. Massachusetts, 18. Michigan, 18. Minnesota's one of the bad states, it's 12%. Mississippi, 21%. Missouri, 22%. Montana, no limit. Nebraska, no limit. Nevada, no limit. New Hampshire, says general laws requires disclosure of finance charge, which is the same as no limit. New Jersey, no limit. 30% criminal usury. New Mexico, no limit. New York, no limit until 6/30/87. North Carolina, 18. North Dakota, 18. Ohio, 18. Oklahoma, 21%. Oregon, no limit. Pennsylvania, 18. Rhode Island, 21. South Carolina, no limit. South Dakota, no limit. Tennessee, 24. Texas, 14-22. Now, Texas banks are moving into Delaware at the present time. The rate's not satisfactory. They can go to Delaware through a shared co-op. Utah, 19.6. Vermont, 18. Virginia, no limit. Washington, 18. That's our neighbor state down south. West Virginia, 18. Wisconsin, 18. Wyoming, 21%. Now, I just want to point out, those are the legal maximum in those states. It's not what the bank cards are charging. The market in each state sets the state limit. I'd also like to point out that Citicorp operates out of South Dakota, where there is no limit. The Texas banks are now moving into Delaware through shared co-ops because they have a limit that's not sufficient to operate on. A state with no limit has some appeal to a large enough credit card operation. I must confess that our card operation with $30 million is not large enough to consider relocating at this time.
Okay, well, I've got one question here. Yeah. You mentioned earlier there that you would bring your interest rate up as a capacity this year up to about 16.5%.
I'd prefer to phrase it, we're going to lower the 18 down to 16.5. And the more affluent who are in at the 12% rate, yes, they will take an increase. Why should the people who are paying 18 subsidize the more affluent people? That's a good question.
How long would you keep that lower interest rate?
Centers, like all the rates in the banking business, depends on the economic situation as a whole.
You keep insisting on talking about these people who are subsidizing the rich affluent people, and I would think that the majority of your people, I would say a good share of your people, are $1,000 limits. And those are the ones that you're really insulting those people.
Senator, how can you lower the 18% if you're not making enough on the 12? That's the problem. If you give us a chance to lower it, to increase that 12, the people with larger balances, then we will be able to lower the 18.
Well, the people pay
in addition,
days Senator, like a credit card is supposed to, then they don't pay any interest at all.
There are two types of credit card
users.
What you
users. Want to do is make more money off of the poor little guy that don't have any of them. That's what you want to do.
There are two types of credit card users, the convenient one and the borrower. There
you
is a distinction.
You want to choke that poor little guy's throat right there. Give up the extra 4%, you little rat.
This is a very hostile committee, Senator. But I know you all well enough. It isn't.
We talk about subsidies, but you keep referring to if we can make these changes, if it expands.
We will be able to.
At the present time, you can't do it because there's a risk factor out there. So what you're saying and what I'm hearing is that you can expand at our risk at those people who had that credit cards here.
No, that's not quite true.
That's what you're saying in your testimony, though.
No.
That's what you sound like.
You said you reached the limit, now you can't go up, but if we change the rates, you can expand.
You're making the assumption that...
So then those who are good credit risk are going to pick up your expansion.
Senator, you're making the assumption that everybody new we take on may be a loss. We take a different viewpoint. We say that the more people we take on, we spread any normal loss over that population base. Now, the big cards have over 6 or 7 million cards outstanding. They can, you know, a problem doesn't give them the problem it gives us. We're not going to be a $6 to $7 million card operator, but we're going to have a nice number out.
You're citing losses for $6,500. Well, certainly, it takes quite a while for a person to get up in the $6,500 limit in your credit card system. They build up a good credit. That's the type of person who go to your bank and probably borrow $10,000. So whatever reason they went broke, it wasn't because of your credit cards.
No, we probably lost money on other loans to them, too.
Money on loans.
We
probably
did in that case.
Yeah.
You
get a Visa card, didn't you? I'm in that 18%, and I don't mind being there. I've only got $1,000 limit because I don't have any money. I don't mind paying if I have to.
With all the harassment you give me, I would still appreciate you passing the bill.
Okay, we do have...
You've got two chances. Slim and none.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sherry Gaw. I'm here representing the Alaska Women's Lobby. The Women's
Excuse
Lobby...
Me, with that 4:30 traffic, you may have to speak up.
Okay. The Women's Lobby has also voted 3 years in a row on the concept of raising interest rates because there have been various pieces of legislation before the legislature during that time, and they have been consistent in placing opposition to this legislation as their number one priority. Our membership is made up of consumers, and they feel that the smaller borrower who can least afford it will be impacted the hardest by raising interest rates on credit cards specifically. Right now, the banks are paying less for the money that they lend, and the interest rates on the credit cards are not dropping, and as a result, the credit card industry around the country is booming. And according to the Federal Reserve Bank, credit card loans are the single most profitable of all loans made to banks. And because there are three bills before the Congress right now that would place a federal cap on interest rates for credit cards, we would hope that this would not be the time that Alaska would choose to raise interest rates on credit cards.
How many members do you have?
I would say maybe 500.
Would you say probably within that range group there that most of them would fall within that $0 to $1,000 range?
I would say that they would be spread as they are in the general population, because we have many professional women as members as well as women who are not very wealthy.
And the majority of the members there of your organization, would it be safe then to assume that they would be within that $1,000 range?
I would say that not necessarily, because many of them might be attorneys or women who might have a larger credit rating. But many of them, of course, will be.
Okay, I guess I was trying to get to is that if Mr. Hall is saying it's correct,
oh, I see,
that if indeed they are within that first $1,000 range, that they're going to pay the 18% regardless, and then possibly with the passage of this, you may be looking
all
at
right. it. What I'm saying is that it would be split in our membership, and that there would be many people for whom the interest rates would raise because they do have a higher than $1,000 credit limit and use their credit cards for.
Those within a $1,000 range are then subsidizing the more, what was that word? Affluent. People that are in
the guys with a dough.
I don't know. You know, it seems that those people would be paying more. The people who are paying 12 on their over $1,000 would then be paying 18.
And
the people who do charge more than $1,000 every month or keep a balance, they would have to pay more if this bill went through, because they would be paying 18 on all of their money that they borrowed, not only the first $1,000.
And the rocks, the cradle, writes the checks.
Sorry, what I'm saying, your membership is cross-section of
I do believe that, yes.
And they've opposed this as their number one priority?
Actually, yes. It comes up every year as something that they're very concerned about, rising interest rates on credit cards. And because there's been legislation, it's been something that's come up as a concern for them.
Any further questions?
I think that women, I listen to what the women say.
Thank you, sir.
When you hear what the leader of the voters say, that's what
Paula?
I asked.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Paula Ziegler, representing today the League of Women Voters. The League supports the position of the Alaska Women's Lobby as regards this bill, and we do so under a position that's nice and broad and flowery sounding, which has to do with the promotion of economic justice. It wouldn't be fair to speak about this bill without acknowledging that bankers and retailers, too, are, of course, entitled to economic justice. But perhaps I can state it the most effectively by pointing out that poor little guy to whom Senator Ray referred earlier is very likely to be a woman, and that's our concern with the bill. Our membership is about 350 in the state of Alaska. Probably a lot of the women's lobby members are also League members, but I would say we could also claim to be fairly representative of the population in terms of credit card limits. I have no data.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Any questions? Okay, was there anybody else here to speak on behalf of?
Let's see, there's 20 banks, 500,000.
If I could respond, I know I don't get this chance very often, but maybe one more time. I think when Sherry Gold was speaking, she's referring to the federal cap. You know, our problem is not a cap today. Our cap is far below what a federal cap may be. So the federal cap has no effect on our problem of extending our credit.
So the federal cap would only stop if we were above what a federal cap would be. We're going to be below that. Another point, I'm sorry we're so misunderstood on this, because our statistics tell us that 2/3 of the people who have a credit card have a balance of less than $1,000. And if 2/3 of the people have a card, I'm sure that it spreads evenly throughout the population as a whole. So what in effect you're saying is that it's proper for the lower income people of 1,000 to help out the more affluent group. And we don't think that's right. Yeah. We keep going back to that. You're penalizing the lower income people who are paying 18, where you're not allowing the people at a lower rate to pay up.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know about the affluent or non-affluent, but the point I think is that here we're sitting over in a session. We'll talk the realities of the situation. We're going to be cutting $120 million out of the state budget, which is not going to be very popular throughout the state. And on top of that, we're going to raise the interest rates. Hey, why not?
I'm not.
We got to survive too, you know.
Was there anybody else here to speak on behalf of House Bill 317? I'm going to leave the public hearing open, and I appreciate the committee's adoption of the Senate committee substitute, and I realize I didn't have the opportunity to look at it in detail and compare it to the original bill that came out. So I would like for you, between now and the next time that the bill is before us, that you review that and then look at the number of questions. I'm not going to give it to you, Senator Gray.
Thank you.
Please,
Mr. Chairman?
No. And there have been some other questions that have come up concerning various parts of the bill I'd like to have looked at between now and the next time we bring it up. Okay?
We do have one more bill there that I would like to go over very quickly.
I'd like to thank everybody who did testify on that.
Thanks a lot, Ed.
Thank you, Billy. Just call me anytime.
No, your testimony was very enlightening. I appreciate it.
Sponsor substitute for House Bill 20. We have the sponsor of the bill here with us, Representative Gall. It's an act relating to interest on deposits collected by public utilities. And we have one other person here scheduled to testify, and there may be others. Representative Gall, if you can give us a very quick overview and remain for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will, and I'll keep it brief. I don't know what information my staff provided you. I hope it's sufficient. I'll touch on a couple of documents in it just to make sure you're aware of them, and if they're not in there, I'll provide them to you. This is the annual report from the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissions that briefs you to an extent on what other states are doing. Let me begin by saying that House Bill 20 is a very simple piece of legislation. It simply says that if a utility is charging more than $100 for recurring monthly service, that they will pay interest to the consumer on that deposit. If you notice on the second page, I guess it is, of this document that I just referenced, it indicates that Alaska is the only state in the union that does not have this requirement. The one just below it, which also indicates, this is on, it's roughly the middle of the page under the word practices on the heading. You see a column of yeses, which indicates that they do require that there be interest paid. Under Alaska is Alberta. That's the only other one on the continent that doesn't. But it's Alaska is the only state. There's also a February 12 memorandum by House Research Agency, which you may wish to leaf through to find your utility. But basically, it's clear at a glance that there are tens of millions of dollars being held in utility deposits around the state. Could I get a copy of the bill from staff? I apologize. I just came out of a CNRA meeting where we had kind of a frantic session, which is why you saw me bouncing back and forth. And I
say tens of millions of dollars.
Yes, sir. There are tens of millions of dollars being held by deposits in the state of Alaska at this time.
Okay.
And if you'd like, I could touch on the key points in the bill itself for you, or it's pretty simple. I think probably the members can understand it. But maybe I should, just for the purpose of the record, indicate to you that many utilities are already paying deposits, that there has been a basic understanding of the propriety of doing this. The money is being held in trust. where the money is placed, and this is, you'll find on lines 14 through 17, or through 16, if the money is placed in an interest-bearing account, which does not mean a trust account or an escrow account or anything of that sort, but if it's just deposited in the bank somewhere, or put into a bond, or whatever you like, the utility is only required to repay the interest that they're receiving, so there's no loss to the utility. If the utility puts it into its general operating monies, as if it had borrowed the money from the customer and was putting it to use, then they would pay what is called the legal rate of interest, which right now is set at about 10.5%. It's referenced on line 14. One last point is that sometimes, and let me make it clear what happens here, a utility is required to return the interest after, I believe it's 2 years, if the person is not delinquent. If the person is delinquent, the subsection B says that the utility does not have to pay them this interest. That compensates the utility for their damage as a result of having to collect on a delinquent claim. It also clarifies the question of what is happening here in terms of subsidies, and if that issue is raised, I'll speak to it. If you'd like, I could speak to it now or wait. But I will say that the result of the discussion is that the way things are right now, the new customer is literally subsidizing the older customers. This would simply suggest that there be no situation like that. And as I say, I can explain
that.
Are
the utilities charging over $100 not for a deposit?
It depends on the utility, and it depends on the type of utility, and it depends on the customer. If you take a look at this sheet here, which is clipped onto the House Research Agency report, it's a long-hanging sheet, you'll see a list of deposit amounts for residential low figure, residential high figure, business low figure, high figure, etc. And if you just look down those columns, you get a sense of the amounts. But the regulations provide as follows. Let's say it's a telephone utility, and you go in for a new phone, and they say, well, we'll charge you a $50 deposit. Well, what they're allowed to charge you is up to twice the average monthly service for a deposit. So if in the first month, and this has happened to me personally, and maybe to some of you in your campaign accounts, which are often targeted for deposits because, you know, people campaigning are not the most stable sorts of businesses sometimes, you might go in for your initial bill, or your initial installation, and be charged a $50 deposit. But lo and behold, you're in an area like yours, Senator, or mine. Your calls are long-distance calls. At the end of the first month, they find you've run up a $400 bill. All of a sudden, you get a phone call asking for an $800 deposit. And this is not unusual. This is commonplace practice to protect the utility. Therefore, you put maybe $800 on deposit, which they can hold up to a year without your being delinquent. You'll have to forgive me here. It's either 1 year or 2 years. That's a regular 2 years. Yeah, it was 2 years, as I stated originally. They can hold it up to 2 years without you being delinquent. Should you then become delinquent, they can hold it longer. Well, this bill says that if you become delinquent, the utility is rescued from that interest requirement for the next 12 months, which would be the period they could continue to hold it. But as long as you keep your credit clean, you would receive interest on your deposit.
Thank you. If you could remain.
Of course. Thank you.
I said I had a couple of questions.
Yes, sir.
This deals with all utilities, not just the public loan utilities, right?
Yes, sir.
Like if you and I and Senator Ray sent us off, we have public utilities, just us involved in it.
Right.
We're all putting money in, and we're supposed to reflect the lowest rate we can because
right.
It is a public loan utility.
Right.
It really doesn't make a great deal of difference whether they give me the interest back on my money if, in fact, they reduce the interest. Service.
Okay, I can
that,
speak to that.
But we're talking to private owned companies, so that's a little different story because you don't have the public involved in it. But I guess we can't separate them out.
Well, let me try to get through that if I could. First of all, by public utility, in the case that you're referencing, you mean like a municipally owned utility?
Right.
Okay. Utilities that are not under APUC regulation do not fall under this bill. And consequently, your municipally owned utilities, unless they request such regulation, would be exempt. The I think it's important, though, for me to address the issue of subsidy, because it does come up. It has been misunderstood, and there have been erroneous statements made in the press, and if I could, I would just take a moment on that. If you'd rather I didn't, I won't.
Go ahead and answer the question.
Just briefly, the issue of lowering the cost to the consumer keeps coming up, and as I say, they are required. All utilities under regulation are required to return to you your deposit at the end of 2 years. When you do the mathematics of it, and I'll do that if I'm asked to, because it's simple, but it takes a good 2 minutes to really go through. But when you do the mathematics of it, you find that the amount of money actually being held in relation to the cost of service is not very great, and the interest on it is even a smaller percentage. That benefit, as small as it is, and the mathematics demonstrate that it is very, very small, but that benefit, regardless of how small it is a benefit that is paid by the people with less than 2 years of service to benefit the people with more than 2 years of service. The utility is required to return your deposit after 2 years. So if there is a benefit, and please do ask me to justify my statement if you like, the benefit is tremendously tiny, and it falls to only one user group at the expense of the other. So the idea here is to provide equity across the board, to say that if there is a benefit that you're going to get to your rate, it should fall to the person who's paying the deposit. He should not be paying a benefit for someone who's not paying a deposit, who might in fact be, let's just say that. So that's basically the argument. This way you get back your savings directly at the end of the billing period, or when you get your deposit returned, or in any schedule the utility likes, and you've gotten your benefit for your time served, but that's where it ends.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dave Hutchins, Executive Director of the Alaska Rural Electric Co-op Association. We represent 15 consumer-owned electric utilities in the state of Alaska. And we do not object to the idea of paying interest on the deposits above $100 that are held by the utilities. We, at the time the bill was originally introduced, we had concerns about the administrative cost of handling this. But with the sponsor substitute and mostly just taking the time to work through the mechanics of it, we're satisfied that it would not be a significant problem. And if it's your wish to for the utilities to pay interest, we certainly have no objections. We, like virtually all other utilities everywhere, do require deposits roughly equivalent to 2 months' anticipated service charges. For the new consumers, and as they prove their credit worthiness with that utility, the deposit is refunded. State regulation provides for 2 years of good credit rating. It has to be refunded. Many of our members concentrate on this and do refund after 1 year, but a few of them pay interest, but most of them do not at this time. We, Mr. Chairman, would propose an amendment to the bill to resolve a different problem regarding interest on deposits that we'd sure like to have your consideration for. I think you've been provided with a copy of it. And this simply makes it clear that the utility can, in fact, charge the, can collect the deposit. And if they collect it, then over $100, then they'd pay the interest on it as the bill now provides. The reason for this, Mr. Chairman, is that presently pending regulation at APUC would turn the deposit system on its head and provide that the utility would have to be able to prove that a person was not creditworthy in order to be able to collect a deposit. And if an entity, say a new business, has no credit history whatsoever, there's no way to prove that they're not creditworthy, even though you may know in your own mind that you're going to get left holding the bag. For example, underfinanced new fish processor, for example, moves in, takes over the remnants of somebody that has gone bankrupt, their new corporation, no credit history, and so the commission regulation would require the utility to provide them service at with no deposit. They'd be a very heavy user of electrical service. They could run up a tremendous bill, and then when the season's over, simply go out of business. And this is a very real problem that we're trying to avoid. When we submitted testimony to the commission protesting this proposed policy, we were informed that there was rumblings within the staff that, well, if those co-ops would object to that, maybe we just ought to do away with deposits entirely. And so we would propose that this amendment be adopted and become a part of the bill and pass it.
Give it to the amendment. It's almost a dichotomy. It says a public utility may collect. In other words, you're just making it permissive, but not mandatory. And then you're saying if you do collect it, then you have to pay interest on the bond. That isn't at all what he's saying. He's saying everyone should pay it. Shall pay interest on that deposit.
Mr. Chairman, the effect.
From mandatory to permissive.
No, sir. We're attacking a different problem. It would still have the same effect that Representative Gall is after, that if the public utility collects and retains a deposit of $100 or more, they shall pay interest on it. But what we're saying here in this first sentence is that the utility may, if it wishes, collect and retain a deposit, which is something that is. Has been traditional in this and every other jurisdiction that we're familiar with, but the commission is now challenging that.
All right, I see what you're saying. I'm sorry. My error. First one I made since 1935.
All right, how do you see that first part of the sentence then, circumventing what APUC has done?
Well, it just makes it clear that a utility may collect and retain a deposit. It just shows that as a right of the utility. Not that they have to do it, but if it's the policy of that utility, they have a right to do so.
What do you say about this?
Speak up right there or whatever.
Okay. Well, just quickly, first of all, I appreciate the support for the bill, obviously. Secondly, I was a little unable to understand exactly what APUC is doing. The remark of staff